Hey everybody, welcome to Space Force, our weekly post-show analysis of movies that came out decades ago. and I am your host, Jason Tondra.
I'm Jim.
I'm Knight Smith.
I'm Professor Christopher McLaughlin.
And we are here with the final episode in this season of Space Force. In our first season, we did all of Picard, which is kind of how this show started. And it was Jim's idea, by the way. If any of you hate the show, it's all Jim's fault. If you love it, I take full credit. But then when we ran out of Picard, we'd started on the films. And we have gone through all of the Star Trek films, including the J.J. Abrams movies. And today is the last one, Star Trek Beyond. Before we've eaten so much popcorn. Say that again, Chris?
We've eaten so much popcorn.
We have. So a little bit of Star Trek news this last week. If you hadn't seen it, the new trailer for Lower Decks show, which is an animated show on CBS, has come out. Abe, you have some strong feelings about this.
Not what I really want from a Star Trek animated show. I can see why they did it. Obviously, Rick and Morty stuff is very popular, and I think that's what they're trying to ride on. Mm-hmm. I honestly can't believe that we can have a show, an animated show from the early 70s, which is more serious and true to the Star Trek series than we can nowadays. I find that utterly bewildering. So instead of getting these kind of the kind of action shows, we used to, especially in the 80s, we used to get Transformers, He-Man, all that kind of stuff. And Generally speaking, they were serious. They had a plot point. Now we're just going, hey, everything animated's comedy. Let's do everything really funny. Ha, ha, ha. And yeah, I don't think I'm that bothered about it. Apparently in the UK, no one's picked it up either. So the likelihood of me actually getting to see it is a remote.
So they've spared you. Like, you don't want to watch it and you won't be able to. So there
Netflix is not getting it in the UK. Amazon have not picked it up either. So it may never even materialize.
Anybody else have thoughts on this Lower Deck show?
I think my son is actually the target audience for the show.
Yeah.
Because it's half of the creative team behind Rick and Morty, which is a show that I'll pop in every now and then. Yeah. I'll be like, oh, that's a clever idea amongst all this potty humor. There's always like a corner of a clever idea. So if they can continue with that sort of approach where there's something small in the way of the silliness, I'll be okay with it. But it's one of the things where if it brings new people to Star Trek and they start crossing over, I think it's healthy for the franchise. And also, I think maybe not so much now with the J.J. Abrams movies, but at a certain point, Star Trek became very serious. Yeah. Like it became very sort of like referential, like especially in the mid to later Borman years. Like, this is important science fiction that we're doing. And the original series, the gangsters for an episode. They're fighting a pizza monster for a whole episode that's eating people. Like, those silly things in Star Trek, and there always has been silly things in Star Trek. So I think if they can, like, my joy's still out. I always want good Trek. My joy's still out. I'm not gonna like weigh in one way or positive or negative. But if it brings people to the franchise and they start exploring the things of the franchise I love, just through like going through the catalog of all the great Trek there is, I think it's a net positive.
You'll watch the first episode just for the uniforms.
Yeah, I'll watch all of it. I've watched bad Trek. Like, I'm not above watching Trek that I don't particularly like. But I know someone out there is going to be like, this is my false exposure, or this speaks to me in a personal way that doesn't speak to myself.
Chris?
Well, I've spent the last 20 plus years just really, really, really enjoying offbeat, weird animated shows. I've got scads of Aqua Teen Hunger Force and Squidbillies and, oh God, just, you know, that just hits me in a special silly place. And, the combination of Rick and Morty and Star Trek, just thinking, yes, I don't think the trailer shows, I don't think it's the greatest trailer I've ever seen, but you know, I'm still on the strength of the idea and the creators, I'm willing to give it a shot. And I just, you know, I just hope that people don't get too worked up about it, because I mean, it's a cartoon show. It doesn't have to be canon. I don't think it cares or how much canon it is, and it may not be everybody's cup of tea. You know, I mean, and there's, but and, I mean, I guess there's certainly something to be said for, you know, maybe this should have been an original thing, and maybe that's ultimately what I'll conclude. But for now, I'm more than willing to give it a shot and see where it goes, because it just the idea seems to be something that I could get excited about.
Right on. So Star Trek Beyond, the last of the three Abrams film, and by all indication, that there's a period on that. Like, we will not get another Star Trek film in that setting. There are continued rumors about it, but I think most of the cast seems to have moved on. Jim, can you put this film in some kind of state of Trek for us?
Wow. Okay. So I've been going over my notes. I didn't put anything on the show notes, but I've been going over sort of like the little notes and the things I remember. So what happened was, this is the only thing that Star Trek produces outside of a couple books that have the logo saying 50th anniversary. That's a celebration or acknowledgement of Trek's 50 years. 2016 is the 50th anniversary of when the Mantrap failed. It's kind of the movie they felt obligated to make.
So there was pressure to make it because of the anniversary?
Because of the anniversary. Star Trek VI came out on the 25th anniversary. That made a statement. So at the same time, we're also hearing about, like, we're hearing rumors about this Star Trek Discovery show.
Okay.
That it was originally intended to air the same year, because it's the 50th anniversary. But because of the split between Viacom and Paramount, between the Viacom companies, Paramount and CBS, there was a lot of chatter back and forth as to saying, we don't want to oversaturate the market, wait 6 months till all movies done, and then you can come out on the 51st anniversary. Well, Discovery had a lot of problems behind the scenes with the showrunner coming in, being fired after the pilot. Yeah. They're currently mired in a lawsuit as to, like, copyright infringement for the Terrorgrade. That season of Discovery is delayed even further than those 6 months. And the initial reason it was going to show up in January of the following year, 2017, would be the 54th year. So this movie kicks around, and they give it to Bob Olsey. Bob Olsey's name is only attached as an executive producer on this film. And there's a reason for that. So they give him the director's reins, and he writes off a script. And I don't know what it is. Maybe Chris has found the script copy or has noticed that. I don't personally, because fuck Bob Olsey. but he told in a script. He told in the script, and it was rejected by Paramount for being too Trekkie. I don't know what that means.
Yeah,
I have no idea what that means.
This concerns me. This part.
Well, remember, Bob Olsey is the one who threw in all of the truthism structure of Into Darkness. So I can only imagine what he'd be, and he had checks and balances. He had Damian Lindelof checking him. He had Alex Kurtzman, and then finally J.J. Abrams is the final say. But him directing a Star Trek movie, it's kind of like, I don't know what that animal looks like, and I'm not sure I want that animal on my planet.
It's like some crazy alternate universe where, like, you elect a game show host president of the United States. You don't even want to think about what would happen after that. It's just so weird.
Yeah. So he tones in the script, and they tone it back, and they say it's too much like Trek. And then he publicly storms out of the office. Like, he severs his connection with Bad Robot. He severs his connection with J.J. Abrams. His writing partnership with Alex Kurtzman had been put on pause. They never will go back to working together again. And again, they were outside of Star Trek. They were doing Transformers. They were supposed to launch the Dark Universe for Universal. They were doing a whole bunch of stuff. And then now they have all the actors set up. They have all the schedules, and they don't have a movie. So they go to Justin Lin, and Justin Lin is the director of some of the Fast and the Furious movies. And he's a huge old school Star Trek fan. Like, he watched it in full-run syndication when he was a kid growing up in, I think, San Francisco.
Yeah.
And he's talked about like how much Star Trek means to him. And this is his passion project. And he came in to save Star Trek. And when he sat down with Simon Pegg, who writes the screenplay, and Doug Jung, who co-writes the screenplay and stars as Sulu's Lovell, they sat down and they were like, okay, this is a rescue mission. We've got 3 months of pre-production to do. What are we doing? And they just structured the story around the idea that they were saving Star Trek. So the crew has to save, like, it's a rescue mission for the crew. Like, right. That kicks off the event, and that's the recurring theme of the whole movie.
Yeah.
Going through the two stories coming out of the movie. So the movie's filmed, it's shot, it's locked. They start doing pressels for it. Now J.J. Abrams is doing Force Awakens. Like, he's focused on Star Wars. He's executive producer in really name only. He's showing up because Bad Robot's involved, but there's like four other production companies also involved in this film.
That's right.
And at this point, he comes out and J.J. Abrams kicks the knees out of this movie and says, okay, we know this isn't going to be everyone's cup of tea, but don't worry, the next movie, we've already signed up Chris Hemsworth, and we're going to do Time Travel. So I don't know what that movie's supposed to be, but even before this movie launches, Star Trek Beyond hits theaters, they're already talking about the fourth one, and that's never a good sign of the franchise.
Yeah, that's supposedly some kind of Kirk's father movie.
Yeah. So the studio has lost faith in the movie. They don't do a well enough job publicizing it, and the big backlash of this movie came from George Takei.
Oh,
George Takei is upset. Yeah. That they turned Sulu gay, as opposed to creating a new character and making him gay.
Okay.
So George Takei has a substantive, nuanced objection to this, and it's spun in the media as George Takei hates new Star Trek, okay. And that sort of monopolizes the conversation. So this movie comes out between these two sort of like hailstorms of a studio that's lost faith in the film, yeah. And this cultural politic war that sort of happens and galvanizes certain factions of the left and right side of the Star Trek fan base.
And to this, we add the stories that I remember, which is the death of Leonard Nimoy, which is commemorated in the movie.
Yeah.
And the death of Chekhov's, of the actor, who's Anton
Ulich.
Ulich. In a sort of freak accident, right as the movie is finished filming. Chris, anything to add to all this?
Well, I found, you know, I was so, just as a personal level, I found it fascinating, you know, to George's objection to the film. I mean, we are in a culture that's completely and utterly obsessed with representation and all that. And George stepping up and saying, no, George Takei is gay. Sulu is not. It is wrong to make Sulu that way. I thought that was such a fabulously uncommon and rare take on things. And certainly not a stand that's going to win George any extra fans. And it was just great to see George actually say something himself rather than, you know, this bot-laden Facebook and Twitter account that he's mostly known for today. So I was just like, wow, George was opposing the Vietnam War while he was making a big budget Vietnam movie. I mean, George is a guy who's not afraid to speak his mind. I really appreciate that about him. So it was good to see that George is not mellowing in his old age.
The interesting thing about that as well is they show his partner,
yeah.
And then that's it. There's no other mention. It doesn't even mention, oh my God, they're attacking the station. Oh my God, my daughter's going to die. My partner's going to die. No mention.
Yeah,
nothing.
You see him with the daughter in a crowd.
Yeah, that's it.
That's it.
So it just seems to be like, well, wasted opportunity or just, you know, I don't know. But it seems weird.
It's a movie series made by box checkers.
Yeah.
And apparently during the conferences, we got to do something. We got to put in something here for you. Okay, we'll do it. We'll have a gay moment. There we go. We got our gay moment. We don't need any more. On to the explosions.
So we've all watched the film. So why don't we give our thoughts on it? I want everybody to know, by the way, that we do notes for the show every episode beforehand. And this week, Aid is the only person that actually wrote notes. So everyone, like, promotion to lieutenant commander for
That sounds good. I'll live with that.
Okay.
But we have to take him from gold to red. It has to be like a gradual transition.
That's right. True. I have been red-shirted all the way through this. So, yeah, I'm quite lucky to survive this all the way through. It's quite good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, as you were saying about the idea with this first script come up originally was like it's too tricky. The approach tend to be was, okay, we need to make a genre film and just paint it with Star Trek paint and then we'll put that out. Which seemed to be like kind of like what the Marvel Universe obviously attempted to do. Ant-Man, okay, we're doing a heist film, it's got superheroes in it, fine. So but that doesn't seem to reflect in the actual final script as far as it still feels like a Star Trek film. It still feels like they haven't tried to force that in there. And I've not seen this since 2009 or whatever I saw it on Blu-ray or whatever it was. It's actually not a bad movie. It's pretty good. There's stuff in it that actually feels like Star Trek, and it's more action-based Star Trek than we've previously seen, but it still genuinely feels like stuff's going on. It kind of fits with the new established universe we have. But there's some bits of it like that are particularly good. Obviously, we've seen. I don't quite understand what was going on with the design of the Yorktown. Why was it so weirdly eschery, kind of bendable, multiple gravities, and say, as I mentioned in my notes, it reminds me of a sigil from Planescape, with a big donut around the giant tower. It's like, why would you design that? So every time you come out your door in the morning, you look up and there's another skyscraper hovering above your head. Surely that would freak the hell out. It's like, and what are the people on there? I don't understand why there's so many people on there that just seem to be everyday people. Is this supposed to be like, they don't mention if it's like some kind of colony movement. They just say, oh, it's a new space station. And we've just got, hey, the guy who fixes your cars on there for some reason. It just seems really weird that there's Starfleet personnel and average people as well. I don't quite know what their actual job designation is again. It seems very odd. The costumes, I always mentioned the costumes. Happy they've gone back to colours rather than the really terrible grey ones we had for Into Darkness, but they're still not quite as good as the original ones we saw in the original Star Trek remake, which is odd again. But at least we have some colour designations on it. I even quite like the outdoorsy suits they have, which do look a lot like Enterprise kind of Discovery stuff with a little thing. They're good. So yeah, that's a good start. Again, it's just. The worst thing about it is, after watching this again, there's so many bits in it that seem to be like, actually, this was not bad. And like I said, but the takings were so low, apparently this is what kind of scuppered production on a fourth film. That's why I held off. And it's like, did anybody watch this film before they, you know, it's because it's not actually that bad. Surely Into Darkness should have been like, oh my God, this is the one you don't want to see. This makes no sense. If you like Star Trek 2, don't go into this because you're going to be ruined. This one is actually like, this is a unique premise. We've got something that's not reflecting on stuff we've previously seen before. We're not Romulans, we're not reusing Klingons. Literally, Nimoy is the only kind of callback to, and in person, the only thing. Obviously, the good thing they are doing is they acknowledge a lot of the Enterprise stuff. We see the design of Franklin actually looks like an NX ship from that era. We mentioned the Makos. We mentioned the Romulan and the Zindi Wars. So we're actually kind of relishing in Enterprise stuff that actually fits the right time period as well for the people that are supposed to be there. So they're not just dragging stuff out of Star Trek lore and going, yeah, there's a Gorn over there and there's an Orion and there's seven Romulans over there drinking beer. They've actually done some research. It's really quite nice. So that's cool. The main crew get a lot of stuff to do individually, which is very, very good. Simon Pegg obviously gets a fairly decent lion's share of the stuff because Sydney wrote most of the script. But it's nice to see Scotty out there actually doing something. Uhura and Sulu team up to do their thing. Bones and Spock do their thing. Kirk does his thing with Chekhov, which is good. Get all the people out of the seats. Nice to actually see something, actually do something, rather than just be like, okay, well, everybody sit in your seats. Me, Spock, and McCoy are going to do the main lifting. Yeah. The odd thing about that is, though, apart from the one character we see, obviously, with the little head crabby thing that managed to hide the doohickey weapon thing, everyone else seems to be like the NPCs the DM can't be bothered to run. It's like, hey, we've got a crew of 700 people on this ship. Yeah, they're not getting names. They're just going to stand in the background and go, hey, for everybody else. We've got the 6-player characters and the NPCs. Nobody else can be bothered to do with the NPCs. They're there for just like to die, be sucked out into space and all this kind of stuff, which is a bit weird. It would be nice if some of them actually kind of got up and did something. And even if it was just to, you know, sacrifice themselves or fight or whatever, that would be nice. Yeah. So that's pretty cool. What was the other thing? Oh, yeah. This is the one thing that strikes me as being particularly interesting about this one is we have a newly introduced female lead character that managed to go the entire film without falling in love with one of the male leads. Now, that is impressive for a movie of this. I mean, that is quite good. There's not even a spark of it, which is absolutely fantastic. We have a slightly different version of Kirk here. He does seem to be slightly more in line with the original Kirk rather than the womanizing Kirk. We don't even get a scene of that in this one. We don't even get a scene of Kirk like eyeing up the new female lead. It actually seems to be they just get on with what they're supposed to be doing. There's no time for messing around. That there is the B story obviously we get with Spock and Uhura is that kind of thing they're playing off rather than, hey, introduce new female character and then Kirk gets a crack and then they get either brushed off or they get together and then we don't see him again ever again. You know? Yeah. So that's quite nice. But all in all, it's not too bad. There's some weird stuff with the sheer vastness of the alien ships, where they all came from, who built them. What I mean, you see, like that little kind of rack they've got on the planetary surface. That when you see the Enterprise face off against that like kind of tidal wave of them, there must be gazillion ships in that tidal wave. And it's like, where, and are they all piloted? That's the thing that seems to be odd. Because if they are, they've just killed like a thousands, million aliens in the Beastie Boys song thing. It just seems so strange that part. This is I assume they're all drones. I assume there was like a couple of like mainly crafted ships, and then a lot of them were drones. Seeing the amount of kind of damage they do actually to the Enterprise, but it's maybe not. Maybe that's it. And again, we see another destruction of the Enterprise.
Yeah.
But we've got an Enterprise 1A at the end of it, which again seems to be like, okay, there's opportunity here to do a new story. We've got an Enterprise A. We've got a new character. We've just introduced this really cool new character. She's actually intelligent. She can do engineering. She can fight. This is potential. You could have a really good thing here, and then it just falls off a cliff and dies. And it's just like it is a shame. It's such a weird state of Trek at that point in time. And I would have been nice to see something different from it, and it would be nice to carry on at some point and do something different with it. I mean, we've spoke about Picard and having like these spin-off shows, and I don't necessarily doesn't necessarily need to be a movie as such, but something else. The timeline, the Kelvinverse timeline, seems ripe for exploration again, or continued exploration. But you know, money talks and all that stuff. Maybe that's it. So that would be
maybe the obvious place for that is the RPG.
Well, yeah, that's very true. You could definitely pull a Kelvinverse RPG out of it, and that would be, or at least play Star Trek Adventures, especially with the Klingon stuff. I'm assuming that's a bit more action based. So, yeah, but I think that's pretty much my entire thing about the movie. Not bad. 8 out of 10. 7 out of 10. You know, better luck next time. That's pretty much it. So, yeah, Chris.
You know, there was this thing going on about 10, 15 years ago where people realized that they, in their, you know, at their local Best Buy and with a decent amount of space, they could actually make their own classic Trek episodes. And some of them went so far as to hire, hey, this was the guy who was security guard number 3 in the Apple. He's going to make a guest appearance in our Star Trek. And, you know, and I you know, there wasn't a whole lot else going on in Trek at the time, so I watched a few of them. And, you know, there's a moment or two amongst the boredom and the really, 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 like, bad amateur, bad local theater acting, where if you squint and it's like 4:30 in the morning, it will kind of sort of remind you of an actual Star Trek episode. And, you know, I'm reminded of that classic quote about if you see a dog riding a bicycle, you don't question how clumsy he might be doing it. You just marvel that he's doing it at all. And you know, you think about the time about the amateurishness and the lack of money, and you just sort of want to applaud and go, "Well done, well done, well done!" People dressing up like Star Trek characters in your garage, well done. And you know, for the most part, that's kind of how this film made me feel. You know, it made me feel like, you know, I just had a Ukrainian sausage dog after writing a paper, and I just turned on my local TV or whatever, and you know, oh man, Star Trek's on, but I find out it's like Return to Tomorrow. You know, you can't really get excited. You know, it's not Doomsday Machine or Amok Time or City on the Edge of Forever, and it's not even something you can laugh at like Spock's Brain or Wink of an Eye or Way to Eden. It's just one of those episodes that's kind of there. You know, oh wow, you know, there's Kirk, there's Shatner with the echoey thing on his voice, and yeah, this is surely a thing. And you know, overall, that's my feeling about this movie. They spent the GDP of a third world nation, and on their third try, they kind of worked up to boring, mediocre Star Trek. And if it weren't for the fact that, you know, yeah, they spent billions of dollars probably to get the same result as people making up cosplay Star Trek in their garage. You know, I mean, I tend to grade on a curb, but I'm like, wow, you really seriously busted your ass, and occasionally you hit mediocre. You know, I don't know how much ultimate credit should be given for that. Now, I wasn't jumping out of my couch and screaming motherfucker at the screen like I did with the first two. So I guess that's progress. But you know, given what went into this, it all seems like a colossal waste of time. And I'm so glad this version of Trek is dead. I'm glad that I lived to dance on its grave. I'm so glad it's gone. And I think I crystallized my hatred for this iteration of Trek down to one moment. I think back to the 70s when Leonard Nimoy quit the Star Trek franchise, passed on the Phase 2 series, initially passed on the motion picture because on a visit to Japan, he found out that behind his back, they were doing Spock beer ads just in Japan. I mean, nobody in America ever saw these things. But Nimoy had enough integrity as an artist and a belief in Star Trek as something more than just a TV show. He refused to have anything to do with the franchise after seeing it. And the very first inkling I had of this movie was a cell phone commercial with fake Sulu pushing cell phones on my TV. So there, you know, we've gone from people of real life experience and integrity and creativity to you know, a bunch of people with the integrity with less integrity than your typical prostitute. This is a Trek that can't wait. This is a Star Trek that can't wait to ram the Beastie Boys down your throat and can't wait to talk about how, well, it's a good thing one of the few things that survived into the 23rd century is this cool, refreshing Coca-Cola beverage. You know, it's a Star Trek made by idiots and whores, and fuck them. Fuck all of them. I'm glad that it's dead. And I think the ultimate lesson we can take away from this whole Abrams verse thing is sometimes it takes three flushes to get rid of the really big piles of shit.
the problem I have with it as well is because it didn't do so well, that puts the rest of Star Trek at jeopardy. And that's the kind of thing. It's like there is a potential for a kick-ass Star Trek series out there. There is going to, you know, there is enough talent out there to be made. And when they do this, they go, "Well, it didn't do great. Well, let's just forget about Star Trek." And it's a shame to kind of. It's like you say, it's wasted opportunities. You do three goes, and then that's it. And you go, "Well, the fourth go would have been great, or the next series would have been great." Yeah, but the movies didn't do too well, so let's leave that. We'll go and make another Fast and Furious.
Yeah, I totally know what you're saying, Aid, because, I mean, this is the film that actually made me somewhat appreciate the Star Trek V scene with Dr. McCoy, you know, because seeing something that I love doing nothing but suffer and having absolutely no dignity, you know, this was the moment where I saw the hell that Star Trek's life had become, and I would have had both feet up against the wall and yanking as hard as I could to get that plug out the wall. You know, this is the thing that made me think I would rather have Trek be dead than become this. If it's just going to be an excuse to hawk cell phones, just, you know, it's time to go out, take old Yella out back and do what needs to be done. But hey, isn't it funny? You know, as soon as we kill this frat boys in space nonsense, we actually have interesting and diverse Trek back again on TV where it should be.
Should we move on?
Yeah, I'm done. Sorry.
Wow. So I'm gonna pack a couple things, but I love this movie. Yeah. Unadulterated. From minute one to minute 210 or whatever it is. I know this film. This is why when they announced in 2009 they're gonna do new Quark, Spock, and Bones, this is what I wanted.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily need them to make a whole movie where they protect my timeline because I still have my DVDs. I still have all of my Star Trek. Like, I just want new adventures of Quark, Spock, and Bones. Well, it lives up to these are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Well, we go out, we voyage somewhere, we meet new people, we meet new aliens, we have a new problem, we work together as a team, we overcome the problem. This is what I want when I want Star Trek. Like, I grew up watching TNG, but I've always had TOS comic books. Like, DC Comics always, you know, monthly was publishing like 75 issues of comic books. So I always had the original series crew in these different permutations, all the novels. They gave me a different version of Colt, Spock, and McCoy that may not have been what the actors intended, but it was iterations and slightly different takes on the characters.
Yeah.
So that's what I wanted when they announced in 2009, we're rebooting the franchise.
Yeah.
Like, I ain't necessarily need 2 hours to be like, okay, your track is protected. Like, I appreciate that they went through that effort, but if it would have given me a better movie, I would have rather have had a better movie than going through all the house cleaning that movie does. That movie does like 45 minutes of house cleaning.
Sure, yes. Totally true.
Now, with Star Trek Beyond, getting back to the major point, I love the costume. So, Abe, you brought up the costuming.
Yeah.
And you said it wasn't as good as when they did the reboot, but still better than the...
In the darkness, ones were terrible. Yeah.
The thing I didn't like about the 2009 costumes is the same reason I don't like Superman's costume in Superman Returns. For some reason, when we got to HD cameras, they decided to just fill up everything with useless noise and visual information.
That's so one thing I noticed. These do not have it. These do not have the dimples and everything. It is an odd choice. After 3 movies, they decide to just, hey, it's just material. Forget about it. Yeah.
Yeah. You can thank HD television for all the texturing on everybody's costume.
Yeah. But it's useless information that I don't need that fills up my screen that as I get older, I get annoyed at.
Okay.
Like, as my eyes are changing, I'm like, there's too much information. I need this, you know, I need not to be bullied every second. Like, that's the problem I have with the new 52 costume designs, right? Like, everything's super rendered.
Oh my God. You read my mind. That's exactly what I was thinking. They're like the horrible Jim Lee new 52 redesigns. Fist bumping you, Jim. Yes. Yes, exactly.
New costumes, they'll strip down. They're solid material. They still do the two-piece. They have a collar. I'm a sucker for a collar. But that's the only thing in the Jim Lee redesigns I like is that most of the costumes have a collar of some sort. And they feel like classic Trek. And even when they jump on the wilderness costumes, as you say, like those, the very, you know, the cage has Pike wearing a jacket to go on to Father's Fort. Like the very first time we see Star Trek in any permutation, they have costumes appropriate to their environment. And we don't really see that in Trek, but whenever it pops up, I'm always like, ooh, like Jason said, I'm a costume nerd. So I really appreciate these costumes.
And Jim, I love the fact, Jim.
Go ahead.
Are you familiar with Fact Trek?
No.
There are a bunch of, like, it's basically like Snopes for Star Trek, and they have one of the best Twitter feeds ever, and they're currently doing like a detailed, like, using original memo breakdown on costumes and logos. So if you guys are really costumes, you should totally check it out. They've dug up some really, really fascinating, deep cut, nerdy details about Trek uniforms and insignia.
Nice. And this is the only franchise I care about that shit.
Yeah.
Like, this is the only thing that, like, when the superhero movie comes out, I'm like, it's not in the comics. I'm not going to get worried about it. Like, I'm never going to see Batman in his underwear. Like, that's
in the DS9 episode when they go back to the Tribbles. And Dax is like, it's so vintage. That's you.
Yes. I like the idea of adding something new to it, like making it a new look. But the 2009 Into Darkness costumes was just overly rendered. Now, getting to the story, I like movies that don't waste a lot of material. Yep. Like, if you introduce something, I want it to pay off somewhere in the movie. Even if it's, like, the best thing about Guardians of the Galaxy 2 is Drax has a comment at the very beginning of the movie where he goes, I can't wear the breastplate because my nipples are too sensitive. At the very end of the movie, he shouts out when they slap on a space, you know, a jetpack on him, he shouts, ah, my nipples. It took me 3 hours to get to that punchline. And it is worth it because it's the best thing that happens in that film as far as I'm concerned. So when they and this movie, like, I've seen this movie so many times that when I was watching it this time, I was looking for, like, construction things. And they bring up these ideas of, oh, Bones is late because he's taking care of Kenzel's cold. And they introduce this idea of how are we going to move all characters out of the holding cell long enough to get the exposition that they need. Like, and that's introduced at the front of the movie. Or even the fact that the Enterprise A is already under construction under a different name. That's more exposition than we ever got for on-screen exposition than we ever got for the Enterprise A and Voyage Home.
Yeah.
And it's just a subtle way of just setting these things up and just paying them off. And this movie doesn't waste anything that it sets up. Now, you can say that there was an excess in action, and I agree with that. I think it could be toned down a little bit. But I kind of like the dirt bike scene. I like that this Corks is obsessed with bikes the way all Corks is obsessed with horses. It's still horsepower. It's just taking this different form and this different iteration. And I kind of appreciate that. I like the fact that they didn't tell us anything about the Nimoy subplot. And the fact that the Nimoy subplot goes back to 2009 Spock's issue of I need to resign my commission because I need to be with my people, and that we bring home that idea and move it forward, I think is just geniusly done. And the fact that they give me the promotional shot from Star Trek V, yeah. My favorite Star Trek movie, is immortalized in this film. I adore that. Like, Star Trek V gets no love outside of the Star Trek Online game and Nimbus 3. Star Trek V gets no love in any of the other permutations of Trek, except this one visual image. And the only reason that image exists is because the whole crew wasn't united when they did the Star Trek VI, because Sulu did all his stuff on a different month, right, on the Excelsior and not the Enterprise. So so those just little things, I can get so much joy out of this movie. When I turn it on, and for the next 2 hours, I'm just smiling and I'm happy. Now, those problems with it, they don't quite convey the diversity through unity message versus the beehive message. You don't quite land that idea, I don't think. But they do bring it back to Kulk having an issue, which is Kulk is lost in space. And I remember when this movie came out, I was like, oh my God, this is back when I had Facebook. This is amazing. They gave Kulk a storyline that A, could have happened in the Prime Universe, which is his decision to leave the captaincy and become an admiral. We've never seen that. It's never addressed outside of Spock saying, you know, your false best destiny is being a starship captain, and anything else is a waste of material. And now we get to see it, and we get to see how that narrative sort of structures, and the fact that he has to contrast himself with this soldier who he himself became lost in space. Yeah. And I remember, Jason, you posted a comment of, I don't know who this Kulk is because he seemed bold with space. Yeah. And I was just like, this is a cult that just, he's on a treadmill, right? Like, he hasn't, like, he's mature. Like, my big thing was he doesn't tone his head when he walks by the female crewman, and he just walks forward. Like, he acknowledges her presence, that slight nod. And once that happened in the beginning of the movie, I'm like, okay, warning for a cult that I'm going to probably like.
Yeah.
And the cult of the original series is riddled with self-doubt. Like, he's constantly going to his codals, and Bones has to go in there and be like, "Go, what's going on? Oh, I'm going to challenge you to do the right decision," right? And for the first time in these Randy movies, we had an inkling of that. Now, I don't think it's as expounded as it could be. Those things I would change, but for the most part, I would say it's an A minus B plus effort. I think it's the best of the Kelvin movies. It's definitely the one I rewatched the most.
Yeah.
I'll probably pop it in another 6 months from now. I'll be like, I'll be thoroughly entertained.
Yeah. Right.
So, Jason, with my gushing aside, take it away.
Well, I enjoyed the film, and I remember when it first came out, my first observation about it was that it seemed to be trying to say something about the character of Kirk, who, like you say, sort of starts off lost. You know, they use that word a lot, a couple of times in the film. Mm-hmm. But it's about kind of recapturing what the spirit of exploration and the spirit of adventure. And what I liked about this film as I rewatched it a couple of days ago is that a couple of times Kirk at the end talks about how much fun it's going to be. Like, well, where's the fun in that? And it's going to be so much fun. And that to me has got to be a callback to Generations, when Kirk dies on the bridge, right? And he's like, it was fun, right? Like, that's this becomes Kirk's canonical motivation, basically for everything, is that it was fun. And I think that the film is trying to capture that. The film is trying really hard to be fun. And I think most of the time it succeeds. I want to get back to something you mentioned though, Jim, which is the number of setups and payoffs in this movie. If you look at there are so many setups and payoffs in this movie. Like, everything we see gets set up so it can pay off later. Jayla being the classic example of this. Jayla's not particularly a fighter. She's kind of scary and intimidating, but she punches the bad guy, one of the bad guys at the end a lot. But she's really there because she's smart. Like, she's got these tricky holographic, the mirror image gizmo and the rock trap. And then they use all those things early so that they can show them off to us again in the big, you know, prison breakout scene. And it's just kind of textbook. Now, to a lot of people, it might seem really boring, like, you know, sort of a check by numbers thing. We're like, well, we did this, so now we have to do that. We put the gun on the mantelpiece, now we have to fire it. But I guess it was just so refreshing compared to all the lazy ass writing that we got in some of the previous movies. And maybe it's not super exciting, but it did the job. Like, it got where it needed to go, and I respected it for that. As I was watching it again a couple of days ago, I was having these Justice League flashbacks. Like, do you remember, like, in Justice League and Super Friends, when, like, some menace would happen and the group would split up, mm-hmm. right? And it's like, okay, Aquaman and Wonder Woman are off doing this, right? And, you know, whatever. And that's what they do in this movie. They split everybody up into these pairs, and it's really smart. Abe, you were talking about this, like, it gets them up out of the chair. And yeah, you're right, it totally does. And the pairings are not, with the exception of Spock and McCoy, which is the obvious pairing, like, you have to do that. But other than that pairing, the rest of them were not what you would expect. Like, if I expected, well, what scene is Kirk going to be with? What character is he going to? Well, if I watched the previous movies, it's going to be Uhura, right? But it's not. It's yeah, go ahead, Jim.
I love that it's Chekhov, because my sort of canonical image of how Chekhov fits in the original series is the fact that, like, Chekhov starts off and he's very much like young Kirk.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he's got, like, a couple female crewmen who he's sort of doting on, and he's just like an unsuccessful Kirk. So by putting those two together and also allowing this Anton Yelchin portrayal of Chekhov to be dumped at the beginning of the movie, like, in a very public way, where he's half dressed, he's half clothed, he's sort of just standing there like, what happened? And then at the very end of the movie, he's hitting on an alien. Like, to move that plot point, though, like that just sort of conforms my interpretation of how Chekhov fit in with the crew outside of the, you know, 60-minute episode. So I love that choice. Like, the choice makes me so happy. And the fact that Anton Liulitz dies, it's so heartbreaking to just, like, and I think that's one of the, like you pointed out earlier, I think that's one of the reasons we don't have Star Trek 4.
Yeah.
Because the family is going to get back together and there's going to be an empty chair.
Yeah, yeah. And so when you're writing a film, let's be honest. Like, if we were just told, okay, I want you to write a big science fiction epic, your main cast would not be seven people. Like, that's a stupid thing to do in a movie. In a television series, you can do it because you've got, what, three?
You make it three people. It's Han, yeah. it's Leia, and it's Luke.
Yeah. And if you're doing a television series where you've got, you know, 22 episodes or 26 or 3 years or whatever, I mean, that's a whole nother story, and you can afford to, you know, spread the love. You're going to have a lot more time to let that cast breathe. But they have to have that because it's Star Trek, and the bridge cast is canonical, and so you've got to have all seven people there. And so how do you handle that? And the answer is you split them up. You Justice League it. And I think it's great. And I really recognize, and I thought we saw this in the last film too. We didn't really get to talk about it much, but that Bones is pushed more into the front with McCoy and with Kirk and Spock, starting with that film, but also in this one. And I like that because I'm an unabashed Carl Urban fanboy, right? So I was delighted by all of that. The Uhura Spock relationship never really worked for me in these movies. So the fact that they spend most of the movie busted up does not, you know, like, good. I'm perfectly happy with that. But they brought it back together at the end in a way that made sense. I love the fact that Kirk is not hitting on every female character he sees. He seems a little bit more introspective and reflective. I think that Pine is trying to show that character aging. He's intentionally interrogating his own previous actions. There's a bunch of callbacks in this movie to other elements of the Star Trek franchise, including the fun bit that we mentioned at the end when he says, you know, where's the fun in that? And but also the birthday toast, the fact that Kirk is having his birthday and there he is with McCoy having drinks. And it's kind of like a homage to the famous scene in Star Trek II. Why are we treating yours like a funeral, you know? And with the added weight that Kirk's birthday is also now the day when his father died. And I see Pine, you know, trying to carry this scene, and I respected it. Now, all that being said, the film gets pretty silly in a couple of, like, the whole motorcycle thing and the beats and the shouting, to quote Jim's tagline down there. You know, it's all very silly. But you know what? Like, okay, let's give it a pass. Like, I'm old man Tondro, and let's let the next generation have a movie that's fun. You know, okay, and it's silly, but like you say, like, there's plenty of Star Trek that's silly too. I have to agree, like, where do all these sudden monsters, like these B ships come from? Because there weren't that many when they blew up the Enterprise, right? Like, there weren't, like, enormous tidal waves full of bad guys back then. But anyway, so it was an entertaining film. I liked it. I would watch it again. But you know, parts of it maybe didn't work as good for me, but writing-wise, this is the first of the two of the Abrams films where I felt the writers did the production and the crew justice. Like, they made a film that rose to the level of the amount of effort that everybody else was putting in.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far.
To that point, Simon Pegg, and to A's point, this got lost in my mental notes. Simon Pegg talks about meeting with the people who run Memory Alpha.
Oh, yeah.
Specifically to flesh out Trek little bits when it involved the Zindi conflict and where they can create this new USS Franklin and tying it all into that. was they met with people who will, like, the Trek fans. They didn't try to educate themselves. They went to the people who knew all the stuff, and they were like, hey, what do I need to do to make this – the Hill's My Plot element, how do I make it within the rule?
Yeah, yeah.
That's like, a cool thing about
the actual effort.
So as a perfect example, like, look at the prison breakout scene. Like, I was so disappointed with Star Trek Into Darkness because of the way that they cannot write transporters, right? Like, every time you transporters would ruin your action scene, you just make the transporters not able to function, even though that makes no goddamn sense, right? Like, and I went off about how, like, okay, yes, you have to write different kinds of scenes when you have transporters. And they did that in this movie. I mean, like, okay, so, like, well, we can't transport out of the valley. Oh, and this friend's like, well, I'll just build some pattern enhancers and we'll get in there and we're like, okay. Like, I mean, I realize it's just a stupid little techno gobbledygook line to, like, explain it away. But it felt like, okay, we're trying to accept the challenge of the setting and we're writing scenes that acknowledge that challenge. And we're treating the audience, I mean, maybe not always, but we're treating you like a little bit more of a grown-up.
So the transport thing was an Enterprise. That was they always said about the cargo that you can only transport cargo, and that's what they had shuttles all the time. So again, they've got the ship in the right era. They've got the right design. It's the first ship that's warp four, so it fits the kind of the canon as well. And they've got transporters that can't transport anything apart from cargo without some enhancement. They've actually done their work. This is why it's so nice.
Is the transporter effect the same as from Enterprise as well?
The sound effect is similar, but
yeah, and I like, but also like it is different though. That is really cool. Yeah, yeah.
All right.
So, a few more things, Jason. Before we move on. So, yeah. I've just realised this as we're going through all this kind of thing is, first of all, source of separation for the original Enterprise. Yay! It's a canon. It's a canon inclusion of the source separation. We've only seen in one comic before. It's actually in there, which is really, really nice. And it wasn't until, again, think about this and watching it all through and kind of playing it back all these scenes in my head. Oh my God, there's no lens flare. It's amazing. I didn't realize it until I've literally just thought about it. It's like, there's none in it. And it's so nice not to have it. It's so unnecessary. And it just makes so much of a difference to it that it feels that you haven't kind of just been, you're not being dazzled every 5 seconds by kind of these bright lights. So that. But the Enterprise set itself hasn't changed. So the idea that they've kind of just toned it down a little bit and just made it feel the same but different is really, really nice. And going on as well about that is, which I forgot to mention, is the bits where we lose gravity in the Enterprise, where the actual set's turning around, is brilliant. I love that. I think it's so nice to actually see stuff kind of being used in its actual environment. We're using 3D dynamics. We're out in space. Therefore, stuff can be upside down. Stuff like that. So whereas we've got the Escher-type space station, which, yes, Kate, technically makes sense if you've got grav plates. But actually just seeing the actual Enterprise gravity shift around, I think is really, really cool.
Yeah. So if you have been with us, we have gone through a lot of Star Trek. And it made me, as we do this episode, which is kind of our last episode of the season, and I'm going to step back for a while. The guys we might have something else for you coming up on some other topic. I don't know, but it made me a little reflective, and I wondered if y'all have any opinions or thoughts on Star Trek as a whole and our journey on this show, and kind of, you know, where we started and where we ended up. Aid, I'm going to put you on the spot.
Okay, so this is kind of about Trek, but it's mostly about this podcast, funny enough.
Good, yeah.
When I watch Trek, I revel in the lore. I love to find all the little bits in it, and I love to learn about the ship. Same as I used to do with Star Wars. I could, knew what T-4 and Skyhopper was and all this kind of stuff, so I know such stuff. But I never went into the actual background stuff of how the films got made.
Yeah.
And the reason about that is because I never wanted to hear about the arguments and the fallings out, because that always felt to me like that would ruin my show. Right. I didn't want to know that Worf didn't get on with this person. But it's so fascinating to actually get to see, hear all this stuff that both Chris and Jim have come up with. They're actually, it actually kind of makes more sense when you look at it and you go,
nice.
Now that makes sense. Now, why does Kirk have horses? Right. Yeah. Okay. Now it makes sense. So it's really nice to actually learn something after all this time that I kind of have circumvented on purpose, but it actually has made a lot of difference. I started watching Star Trek. I saw a lot of it. The odd episode of Classic Trek. We used to have it on BBC Two, 6 o'clock. They used to see the odd one here and there, but they would never show off. You'd get like the odd season here and there, and they'd kind of dash around, and some stuff get missed, and they'd show stuff out of sequence. So the first thing of Star Trek was Next Generation. Yeah. And we got the a couple months after the US, and they were talking about the Naked Now, Naked Time. Is it Naked Night Time or Naked Now? I can't remember which one the remake.
The Naked Time is classic, and the Naked Now is the Next Generation.
They were talking about that, because they go, oh my God, there's stuff going on Enterprise. It's got sexy stuff going on. And that was in the Sun newspaper, so that's not surprising, really. So yeah, it's like, and that's, yeah. And that's how they sold it in the UK for the first ever thing about this new Trek. It's like, what the hell's going on here? But it's a great show. And I know I've always liked the show. And it's always been – I've always been someone that doesn't mind action scenes. But there's always been a central thing where, yeah, the problem-solving stuff, the kind of that kind of slow pace of this is the problem, get it solved, this is the solution. And there's always, you know, it's either done well, isn't it, some bad outcome or whatever. But I always like the idea of with this Next Generation is where you pick up plot threads from episodes and this, that, and the other, and it would all feed through to actually make a whole kind of encompassing universe. So seeing stuff all the way through to now, I see that in Enterprise, I see that in Discovery, and I see them at least trying to acknowledge stuff. And so seeing the new movie, the kind of movie we just seen, acknowledge that is really, really good. But I'm not quite, so I've enjoyed Picard, I've enjoyed Discovery. They've been different takes on Trek. They haven't been the Next Generation we've seen previously. They've not been the classic we've seen previously. And as I mentioned about me not too bothered about Below Decks or Lower Decks, which one it is, because I'm always getting mixed up with the episode. I can see that some people can say, well, it's not Trek. Well, some people complain that Picard was not Trek, but Picard was more Trek than that was. But I can see that, as Jim said, it's an introduction to the show. So you kind of let it settle, and that's the way it goes. I mean, but it's odd. I really hope there's more stuff coming along. I would like to see another series set after Next Generation in the same time period as Picard. I'd like to see something kind of that kind of build onto what we've seen there, especially kind of just the, kind of those side notes and like the ranges we see with 709. But all in all, I just don't want to see bad Trek. That's pretty much all I can say. And again, I mean, say my love of Trek obviously got me to actually do stuff for the Star Trek role-playing game, which is, which is bewildering. I find that absolutely fascinating that after, back in 87, 88, when I was looking at it and they're saying, oh, Deanna Troi's on Star Trek, I'm actually writing our stats up for the Next Generation role-playing game. Like, it's utterly nuts. And I love that. And I'm so grateful for the letter to allow me to do it and getting involved in part of that lore kind of thing. So, So, Chris, carry on.
Well, not to get too deep into my personal life, I grew up in extremely rural Virginia where, your career options were coal miner and coal truck driver and coal train operator. And Star Trek came in my life in the middle of that. And it just, it's really hard to describe what that meant to a kid with an imagination that could not be contained by the mountains. Just this reminder that there was a larger universe out there and that, there was opportunity. You could explore things. There were dangers, but there was also hope and optimism. And Trek and I bonded at a very, 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 very bonded very deeply and richly. And for the most of my life, it's been a very, 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 very rewarding and worthwhile experience. I mean, it's just really, really hard for me to describe just how inspirational and formative that show has been to me. Yeah. And especially during my extremely lonely years where, I was ostracized because I did things like read and think. I've always said I'm the luckiest man in the world because I've only ever had one life goal, and that was to escape my hometown. I did it 30 years ago. I've been taking a 3-decade victory lap. I'm good. I can spend the rest of my life celebrating. I hit my one goal. And again, not to get too deep into my personal life, but I've had a really, really, really brutal last year or so. It's been feeling very, very lonely and isolated. And certainly, you know, until Discovery and its ilk came along, there wasn't a whole lot of comfort and joy in Star Trek anymore. But, you know, to see the franchise rebound, especially, you know, with these previews for the next season of Discovery, where it's people who, you know, the dream of Star Trek and the Federation are kind of synonymous for the most part. But, you know, seeing people, you know, these people in a future where, you know, like the Federation has been run on the ground and destroyed by people that didn't understand it and appreciate it. That's kind of how I feel, and I guess a lot of people feel about the whole Abramsverse thing did to the franchise. But it's these people who even predate the classic show, reminding people of the value and the beauty of and the aspirational nature of it all. That to me is why I'm really, really excited about season three of Discovery. You know, it seems like it's a good idea for its own sake, and it's a complete repudiation of the Abramsverse. It's getting back to the things I love about the series. And in the midst of my own personal turmoil and torment, you know, I had the opportunity to come and be a part of this, and it has meant the absolute world to me. You know, I mean, it's all, Jason, you're one of the finest human beings I've ever met. We don't get to spend enough time together because of this damn continent in the way. And it's been just a great opportunity to spend more and more time with you. And Jim, I want to party with that dude. Jim, you are a fucking animal, my friend. You love this stuff like I do. You know your shit, and you hit me at least once a week, and usually multiple times. You come up with something brilliant, even if we were talking about, the fifth movie or Insurrection. So good on you. And Aid, oh man. My brother across the pond. Love you, man. It's been great. And thank you all for letting me be a part of this. It's been a dark time for everybody, but this podcast has been a light in my life, an opportunity to talk to more than one human being at the same time. It's a crazy treat amidst this plague. And, in the best possible way, it's reminded me about how the show found me during a dark and lonely time in my life. And now it's come back to me with three of the best people I could ever want to discuss it with. And I really, really, really super hope that we're going to be doing this again very, very, very soon, because I'm going to miss every second that we're not doing this.
Jim.
Notice Chris didn't say I said anything smart in all the podcasts, by the way.
You do. I was overcome by emotion, man. You and me are the Blake 7 wing on this show. Come on, you know I love your shit.
I didn't say anything smart either.
Look, there's a reason I love you. It's because you have fucking insight on this. I mean the Shakespearean breakdowns and everything. Get out of here, man. You're awesome.
We're not fishing for compliments. We're just giving you shit. Chris? I mean, Jim?
Well, where do I follow up after that?
See, you always have to follow Chris. Like, this is the hardest spot. Like, I put you in the tough job.
Yeah, but I think I can hold my own. So there was something that Roger Ebert said, which is that movies are machines to generate empathy. Well, something to that effect. And that's how I've always sort of viewed Star Trek. Like, Star Trek at its best, at its finest hour, are people working together to solve a problem. Sometimes that problem is existential, sometimes that problem is internal, but there's a problem, people come together, and they try to solve it.
Sometimes they've stole the brain of your science officer, you know, it's
And sometimes those problems are silly, and sometimes, you know, you're dealing with tribbles, and sometimes those problems are, you know, you're dealing with geopolitics and Star Trek VI. And this podcast, like, 2020 has been an awful year. And I don't know about your personal issues, Chris, and I don't want to air anything out. I'm just saying, like, globally speaking, we're all in this moment of trauma. And all of our houses have become little starships, right? These little... Like, we go out and we have to mask up. We have to suit up to go outside and get food and bring it back here. And, you know, we have to do these rituals to try to make sure that we're healthy, because we're fighting an invisible enemy in the pandemic. And we're fighting a structural enemy in the sort of racism that we're dealing with systemically throughout America. And we're just sort of all struggling. And like the thing that Star Trek tells us is it's going to be okay. Jonathan Frakes said the reason he signed up to do Star Trek was because Gene Roddenberry sat him down. And he was having doubts as an actor. And he goes, in the future, there will be no war. There will be no poverty. No child will go hungry. And he said it with such conviction that Jonathan Frakes signed up to be Will Riker, the best character in Next Generation, as far as I'm concerned. My favorite, at least. He signed up for just on that little speech. And Jonathan Frakes will always tell you that story. It's his Martin Luther King, Nichelle Nichols story. Like that's the story he constantly tells and retells. And that's what Star Trek is. And sometimes you have to do work for that. Sometimes you have to strive for that. And this podcast has helped, because it has allowed me to, with empathy and understanding and listening, to views that sometimes contradict my own.
Yeah.
Like, I know I'm an iconoclast when they say Star Trek V is my favorite film, and my favorite films are the ones that are most like the TV show, for good or ill. And I can support that argument. And I know that I can come here and be whole, and you guys may not agree with me, but you can see at least my reasoning, at least my logic going into it.
I like that movie a lot more now than I did before, so.
And it's taken me a long time to love that movie.
Yeah.
Like, it took me a long time to come around on that film, because I was like one of those, Star Trek 2 is the best. And I'm like, but Star Trek 2 for me isn't Star Trek. Like, it is, because we've adopted it as such, but it's a different beast.
Yeah.
You know, especially when you go through and you watch it in a linear fashion. And this show has been an outlet for that. Just ability to heal. Like, I didn't know that they sold Next Generation in the UK as a sexy show with a middle-aged, balding lead and no, like, sex in Star Trek. That's how they sold it?
Deanna Troi and obviously, oh my God, I've gone completely blank. Denise Crosby, yeah. That was the, like, hey, they all get old up in the third episode. So, yeah.
And I would never have thought about, like, because Star Trek is so synonymous with sort of American colonialism in terms of, like, how we sort of see ourselves as pioneers and how we go out and we solve other people's problems. Like, those that is built into the franchise. You can't really bake it out of the cake the way it's set up. And to hear what someone from Britain, their take on it has been invaluable. To hear what someone's take on that from the East Coast, from Virginia, has been invaluable, because these are not opinions that I am in my, you know, West Coast little bubble and I'm exposed to quite often. And I've thoroughly appreciated it. There's been times that I haven't wanted to do the podcast because of personal reasons. Like I'm done and I'm exhausted, or I feel like this is going to be an argument issue. Like, I didn't want to do the Nemesis podcast. That one was tough for me. And it took a lot out of me to do that, to say what I said. And I've always known that if I said something here, I'm going to be listened to, and I'm still going to be respected after I've said my piece. And I can only put that down to all shared spirit that life can be better if we start treating each other like each other, like people. Like, we start walking with each other. And some, we're not always gonna agree. But the fact that we put in the effort to hear each other out and to try our best not to talk over each other. Because I know, Jason, that's been your problem with the show. I know I've contributed to that.
I do it myself so often, I have no grounds to throw any stones.
Yeah. I do too. I apologize.
We all do it. Well, like, really, I do that at my house all the time. Like, I do that with my family. And I don't mean anything by it. I'm just trying to get my point out.
Chris,
is there anything more Star Trek than the fact that that we all love each other at the end, no matter what happened in the preceding 51 minutes?
Yeah.
And with that, I really appreciate the show. I appreciate the opportunity. Whatever listeners are out there, I appreciate you guys for downloading us on your devices, bringing us into your homes, into your lives. Like I said, like we're all on these little spaceships called our houses, and it kind of sucks sometimes. And I feel like going, oh my God, yesterday is just like today, and it's going to be what tomorrow is. Yeah. But this show has sort of brought me a joy of, okay, Sunday, even if I don't want to do it, I know I'm going to have a good time while I'm doing it, and I'm going to feel good afterwards.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you guys for doing that. And Jason, with that, I kick it to you.
So first off, thank you to everybody who's been listening to us. And Mike Lafferty, who gave us a platform to do this show. We're all like only a few people come in, like loyal watchers who come in, Dale and Carrie, and you know, one or two other people have come in, and Carrie, I know you're gonna give me shit if I wasn't eating, so you can't see it, but like lunch is right back there. But so thank you to everybody who has listened to the show and come along with us on this journey. And thank you to my fantastic and dear friends and co-hosts here on this show. I would never have done it without all of you. Jim, this is your idea. But everybody has made this show ours, and I'm deeply grateful for that. When we started 22 episodes ago, is that right, 22?
Something like that.
I asked by asking, what is Star Trek? Because one of the most frequent critiques of whatever version of Star Trek we're looking at, whether it's Lower Decks or the Kelvin universe or whatever, or Picard for that matter, is people will say, well, that's not my Star Trek. And I wanted to know what that meant, right? Because it seemed like a sort of impossible target to hit. And I don't think this journey has changed my mind on that. I think what's the thing about Star Trek is, but it's helped me understand why it is. Star Trek is aspirational. One of the words we all use is the idea of hope, right? This idea. And then the first Star Wars episode may be called A New Hope, but there's actually not a whole lot of hope in Star Wars. Like, it's basically perpetual warfare all the time. I mean, it's called Star Wars. It's not called Star Peace, right? But Star Trek embodies that hope, and it's very aspirational. It's very upfront about its desire to paint a better, not just a better future, but a better version of ourselves. And maybe that's, and here's the thing, because then when each of us, when everybody watches Star Trek, well, of course, we all have different versions of the best version of ourselves, right? Like, what I think my best self is very different than what anybody else's thinks their best self is. But all of those different versions of best self become wrapped up in Star Trek. And Star Trek is the best version of, you know, 300 million Americans. And so it's got 300 million different answers. So what is Star Trek, right? It's everybody's best image of a future, of an idealized future, and an idealized self that doesn't exist. And so, of course, it includes everybody, because everybody has different expectations, and they often can't even voice them. If you ask somebody, what is Star Trek? And they'll say, well, you know, you're like flying around in a spaceship meeting aliens. Okay, that's not what it's really about, people, right? It's not what it's really about. But we don't know how to talk about it. And so as we watched all these different shows with all their different pluses and minuses, all of their peaks and their tragic flaws that never, very seldom made me mad, but very often made me sad, because they could have been so damn good, right? But they just didn't rise to the level of their own aspiration. I really have come to appreciate what I've been saying throughout the show, that every version of Star Trek is somebody's favorite Star Trek. And I think that's good. I think people should be allowed to love it, because it's speaking to them in a personal way that nobody else is going to get. It's playing on something inside their head, like, you know, that version of them that they imagined when they were 8. And maybe I don't get it. I just don't get that episode, man. But you do, and it touches something inside you, and it makes you want to be a better person. And ultimately, I believe Star Trek can help make people better versions of themselves. And if we can all just be a little bit kinder and a little bit nicer and a little bit smarter and a little bit more creative and imaginative and a little bit more open to what other people are thinking and a little bit less obsessed with ourselves, then Star Trek is a good. Star Trek is a capital G good. And it's been an honor and a privilege to take this journey with all of you over the past few months. 5 months. Yeah, like 5 months. Six, because we missed a couple of weeks in there. So we've been going for an hour and a quarter, and we're gonna split. So live long and prosper, everyone.
Peace and long life.
One more thing I should mention. Sorry, I know I always ruin it. Someone's got to say the last word. This time's going to be me rather than Chris say half a sentence. Yeah. Kobayashi Maru is a free download adventure on DroidFrog.
I saw that.
You can actually find your way if you can solve the unsolvable puzzle of Kobayashi Maru yourselves in the Next Generation or in the Star Trek role playing game. So definitely worth a look. It could be quite fun. So, yeah.
Good night, everybody. See you next time.